This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, May 31st. We turn the corner to June tomorrow. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We'll speak with Daniel Greenman of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent and Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. CAI's Patrick Flannery will be speaking to our Statehouse correspondent Katie Lannon, and Will Sennett of the New Bedford Light will join us. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Today marks 5 years since the nuclear reactor was shut down for the last time at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station in Plymouth. The plant was and continues to be controversial because of the debate over nuclear safety and nuclear waste. CAI reporter Jeanette Barnes has been talking with some of the people who've been involved in Pilgrim since the 1980s, either as activists or employees, to reflect on this anniversary. And Jeanette joins us now. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
So first, remind us a little bit about what was happening at the plant 5 years ago. What was the context for the shutdown of the plant?
Sure. The activists had been protesting Pilgrim for years, actually, some even before it opened in the 1970s. But when I talked to people this week about what was influencing the shutdown, the people who were involved and even the owner of the plant at the time, which was Entergy, said the reason really was that it was shut down permanently really was money, the economics of running the plant and producing that energy there at that time. So the company made the announcement about 4 years ahead of the actual shutdown. And at that time, gas prices were pretty low, making nuclear energy less competitive. Also, the state of Massachusetts had been formulating some financial incentives for clean energy and made the decision to leave nuclear out of the mix, out of the eligibility for some of those incentives. And then the company Entergy talked about another factor in their announcement. They said they'd spent hundreds of millions of dollars to try to improve safety at the plant. That was because Pilgrim was under some enhanced federal oversight for a number of years because of safety issues there. And the company really wanted to be released from that extra level of oversight, which they were ultimately released from that just a few months before the final shutdown. But the work that they did to achieve that, they said, was an expense that was part of the equation. And so for a number of financial reasons there, it seems Entergy decided it wasn't going to be able to operate Pilgrim any further.
Now, you talked with David Noyes, who worked at the plant at the time that this reactor was shut down. He still works there as a compliance manager for the current owner, Holtec. What were some of his memories of the last day of Pilgrim running as a nuclear plant?
He worked during the daytime, but the final shutdown procedures were actually done during the night shift. So he was not in the room at the moment, but he said that it was definitely the end of an era for people who had been working there a long time. He had been at Pilgrim since 1989 and is still there. And he said there were a lot of people working there operating the plant who were really committed to running it safely, who really believed in nuclear power as a non-fossil fuel source of electricity. So he says it was kind of a down moment for him and for the other long-term employees. But the way he characterized it this week, though, also was that it was also the beginning of the commitment to decommission the plant, to clean up the property to the best that they can and make that available, that land in Plymouth available for some kind of other productive use.
I know you also interviewed Mary Lampert this week. She's one of the longtime activists who had been calling for the plant to be shut down since the 1980s. What did she recall about the time and this shutdown?
Well, she did want to give credit to the people who protested Pilgrim before it even opened in the 1970s. She moved to Duxbury in 1986 and became active around that time. So she did a lot of protesting herself. She said she'd like to be able to take credit for the plant closing, but it really was about the money. But she said one thing the public advocacy did do in her mind was to push the state not to include nuclear power in those clean energy packages, clean energy financial incentives from the state that were being created at that time. So she says that part did make a difference.
You've been doing a lot of reporting on the decommissioning of Pilgrim. We know that the fight continues over what will happen to the contaminated radioactive wastewater in the plant. But there's also the question of what will happen to the spent fuel long term, which is the kind of big picture question that people might be thinking about on this anniversary.
That's right. Yes. I mean, the opponents and supporters of nuclear power both acknowledge that how to deal with all of that waste is really is kind of one of the big existential concerns for nuclear power going forward. I mean, David Noyes, who works for Holtec, said waste has been like the biggest thing detracting from the nuclear industry for a long time. He wanted to give some examples of ways that nuclear fuel can be reused, spent nuclear fuel can be reused. He was talking about the military repowering ships with nuclear fuel, and some countries reprocessing the fuel to reuse the usable materials in it, kind of like recycling. Of course, many other people feel that the burden and the risks of the waste are just too much. Mary Lampert, when I talked to her this week, said she said some nuclear waste will be dangerous for as long as the dinosaurs have been extinct. Think about that, she said. There's a lot of debate still. And the other thing too is the safety of that waste is only as strong as the federal regulation of it, and there are definitely people questioning whether the federal regulation is strong enough.
Let's talk for a minute about some of the other Pilgrim news that you reported this week. Holtec, the company that is decommissioning the plant, has responded to the state's request for more information on potential air pollution from the plant. Tell us what the latest is here.
Sure. So this is kind of a follow-up to a story we had in March when Seth Pickering of the Department of Environmental Protection said in a meeting about Pilgrim that the information Holtec was providing on potential air pollution was inadequate. So his agency, the DEP, followed up with a letter to Holtec outlining the problems. Then Holtec replied with more data. So they've now release that data. This is on non-radiological pollutants in the water at Pilgrim and how much could be emitted into the air as that water evaporates. These substances include things like potassium, zinc, boron, nitrogen, and oil and grease, things that have gotten into the water. If the Holtec numbers are correct, the state says that these levels of possible air pollution from this are actually well below what would trigger air quality permitting through the state process. So the DEP says that they are still reviewing, though, the Holtec's response. Seth Pickering did say in the meeting the calculations appear to be correct, but state's still doing a formal review of it.
And as you mentioned, this water is evaporating right now at the site. It's going off into the air. And the numbers that you're talking about there, that the DEP is looking at, they don't include the radiological material, the radioactive material that we know is also in the water there. That radioactive material, that's being tested for separately, right?
Yes, Holtec has agreed to do another round of water testing for radioactive material. And they've said they'll include more types of radionuclides that are harder to test for compared to what they did last year. So certainly people are anticipating what was going to happen with that. But the collection of water samples for those tests is scheduled to happen next Tuesday. It's not necessarily you won't necessarily have the results that day, but that's the sample collection day.
Let's turn to some news about floating offshore wind. The public comment process for floating offshore wind off the Outer Cape is just getting underway. This is kind of just developing before our eyes, almost, it feels like. But in the meantime, the Biden administration has given the green light to a small group of floating turbines for research purposes nearby, but closer up to Maine. Tell us about this.
Yes, the state of Maine wants to put 12 floating turbines in the water for testing in conjunction with the University of Maine. And this is an area about 32 miles southeast of Portland. If you're asking yourself out there, why is CAI reporting on Maine? It's because this floating technology is probably going to be necessary in order to put offshore wind turbines off the lower and outer Cape. And that's because the water is deeper there than it is off Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket. So these floating turbines seem to be what people are focused on. So Maine is trying it out. And the kind of the news this week really is that the federal government said Maine does not have to go through the longer approval process that they use for commercial wind farms in order to do this research project. So they could be putting up to 12 turbines out there. The state of Maine has 30 days to decide whether they're going to accept the lease agreement as offered by the government or ask for some changes to that agreement. And then, most likely they'll be moving forward.
All right, for listeners who are just sitting up saying, did she say offshore wind turbines off the lower and outer Cape? This is a proposal. And tell us just briefly in 1 minute here, what's happening with this proposal and how people can find out about it?
Yes, so the federal government has identified eight possible wind areas, wind lease areas. These would be kind of like the, how the developer of Vineyard Wind leased an area south of the islands. These are areas like that. And these are undergoing a longer public approval process. Some informational meetings have already happened, but so there are some more public Zoom meetings still happening in early June. Some of these are going to be focused on specific areas of interest, like commercial fishing, shipping, recreational fishing, and environmental concerns. But I believe that really anyone can attend. If you miss the sort of more general one that already happened, you could probably go to these meetings and learn about what the plans are out there. Again, these wind areas for turbines are off the east side of the Cape. And we do have some links actually on our website, in our Gulf of Maine stories. In the last couple weeks, we have links to register for those Zoom meetings if people are interested.
And people can also find that on the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management website, BOEM.
That's right. Yeah, if you Google BOEM Gulf of Maine, yeah.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
If you have taken a walk on the beach lately, you may have noticed horseshoe crabs seem to be everywhere. CAI's Eve Zukoff has a story this week about what happens during a spawning season for horseshoe crabs and how officials are trying to protect the species. She joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
This story took you to Stage Harbor in Chatham, where kind of a remarkable scene was taking place. Walk us through what horseshoe crab reproduction looks like.
Sure, it's a very involved process. Basically, the females head to shore by the thousands. And this is kind of happening from the Yucatan up to Maine. It's kind of the peak of it is really happening in Delaware, people probably know. But there's a lot of action on the Cape and really all across Massachusetts. So the females head to shore in very shallow water, and these males just start desperately looking for them, kind of hot on their heels, if you will. And they're trying to latch on to the back of the female shells. One of the differences between males and females is that males have this like special leg that can kind of hook on to the back, and they will try to just stay there until the females head to kind of the high tide line area where they lay about 80,000 eggs below the sand. And then the males try to be the first ones to fertilize it. But what it ends up kind of creating is this really intense competition between the males. So you'll see like conga lines of horseshoe crabs where there's a kind of the bigger female in the front. She's about 30% bigger than the males. And then like six males all kind of clipped on behind her, jockeying for position.
Okay, there's a lot there, but we're going to charge ahead and say that we should point to the fact that this process that you're describing has been going on for about 450 million years.
Yeah, this is my excuse to just kind of talk about horseshoe crabs and how amazing they are for a second. They have outlived dinosaurs. They've survived mass extinction events. They're fascinating animals, more closely related to ticks and spiders and scorpions than anything in the ocean. They are absolutely fascinating and pretty successful and resilient. It seems like they can do this kind of reproduction in a bunch of environments. They are slow moving with no natural defenses, but they are one of the most kind of strong and resilient animals I can think of.
Mm. So spawning season, which is happening right now, is really an opportunity for volunteers to get close to them, the human volunteers. What is their role in all of this?
Yes. So volunteers are counting horseshoe crabs on beaches statewide to help the state develop a sense of how safe and robust the population is. So from April through June, volunteers around high tide, basically every day, get some supplies from the state. And what they'll do is they'll plant two stakes, PVC plastic stakes, about 5 meters apart. And then they walk in that area and count how many horseshoe crabs fall within this, you know, basically 5 square meter area. The state needs 700 volunteer slots filled, which is a ton, and they could use some help. So this story was kind of looking at what does that process even look like?
Just briefly, what are some of the challenges that are facing horseshoe crabs? Like, what is it that's impacting the population the state is trying to manage here?
Yeah, the state is trying to manage how many horseshoe crabs are harvested by fishermen for bait, and also how many horseshoe crabs are harvested by biomedical companies, because they harvest horseshoe crabs blood. They extract about 30% and then release the horseshoe crabs for drugs, vaccines, medical devices. There's like a 15% mortality rate there. And there is some debate about the overall population size of horseshoe crabs, but the state believes that for the most part, the population is actually doing quite well. On 16 beaches that they survey, 70% of them have an increasing population trend over the last 10 years.
And this year is the first year that these species is protected throughout this very vulnerable spawning season all the way through.
Yeah, exactly. This is the very first time that the state is shutting down any harvesting for about a month and a half long period that ends in just a couple of days now. So this is a really good time for people to go to beaches, see what horseshoe crabs are doing, and please leave them alone.
CAI's climate and environment reporter Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thank you.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll check in with Daniel Greenman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. A tragic story this week of a man with vineyard connections who was arrested after allegedly stabbing a number of people on the South Shore and eventually crashing his car after a police chase in Sandwich. Daniel Greenman of the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us with this story. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, how are you doing, Steve?
There's a lot here. I'm almost not sure where to start, but I want to ask you about the suspect, Jared Ravica, and what we know about his connection to the vineyard. What can you tell us?
Absolutely. So, the Times broke the news that he had vineyard ties. Ravica lived on the island since about 2021 and has photos of himself all around the vineyard, as well as connections to vineyard addresses.
And maybe give us a sense of what seemed to unfold on this night that has now sort of thrust him into the news.
Absolutely. So Ravica is the suspect now in 6 knife attacks on the South Shore from Saturday. He's also under investigation in connection with a man found dead Saturday in Deep River, Connecticut. And these attacks are of 2 employees at a McDonald's, as well as 4 people at a movie theater in Braintree.
And right now he's being held at Bridgewater State, is that right? The hospital there?
Yes, it's a medium security hospital at Bridgewater State Hospital. And he's behind a barbed wire. He's being held there right now.
As this story unfolded, you worked to try to put together the picture of what his connection to the vineyard was. As you say, he seems to have lived there since 2021, but not in a fixed location. And there's a little bit of confusion about where he was, what his address was.
Absolutely. In recent court filings, in fact, he listed his address as the same address as the Chilmark Post Office, though he does not have a post office box there. He also was arrested in April for an attack on his father at an address in West Tisbury, though that address is not in his father's name. So his connections are a bit murky as far as his establishment on the vineyard. And we have also talked to people who remember him in Chilmark specifically. from recent years.
Tell us a little bit about your conversations with folks who had interactions with him and his father in Chilmark.
Absolutely. So the times did catch up to some people in Chilmark who recalled seeing him around the Chilmark General Store, especially last summer. People told the Times, people told us that he was there almost every day last summer with his father, ordering coffee and sandwiches, and that they had a memorable look, at least, to people with long blonde hair who were there quite often. There was one incident in particular that people around the Chilmark store mentioned where he and his father got into a heated argument with a young woman regarding a parking situation. Apparently, reviews have thought that the young woman had almost scratched his black Porsche Macan, the same that he recently totaled, fleeing from police after his stabbing attacks.
This is somebody who is, even by the court here's definition, suffering from mental health issues. What do we know about what happens next for him in this process? He's been, he was apprehended after this police chase that ended up crashing his car, rolling it over, and really totaling the car, as you say. What do we know about where he's at now and what happens next in the process?
Absolutely. Raviza is, again, currently being held at that medium security facility. And a court-approved psychologist determined that he is suffering from an active psychotic illness, as well as having serious delusions that his family is involved with the mafia and that he was controlled by outside forces. So this same doctor determined that Raviza did not have the mental capacity to work with his attorney. He has been ordered held without bail at Bridgewater until his next hearing on June 17.
I want to ask you a little bit about the victims here. There were some young women at a movie theater that he's alleged to have entered the theater and slashed at them with a knife. He was carrying a kitchen knife. Is that right? And tell us what their condition is. Nobody was killed here, and they seem to be not direly injured. Is that right?
Yes, thankfully there are not life-threatening injuries in these cases. There were, four girls aged 9 to 17 at that movie theater in Braintree, as well as two people at the McDonald's. And yes, thankfully there are not life-threatening injuries involved.
Yeah. He was going through a McDonald's on the South Shore there and stabbed the person through the takeout window. Is that right?
Yes, he drove up to the drive-through window in that same Porsche and ordered food, ordered two cheeseburgers, and according to the shift commander at that restaurant, Raviza yelled at employees and said he would not pay for the food unless his order was done correctly, and then he pulled out a knife and attacked.
And then it seems that there's an incident in Connecticut directly before all of this unfolded that he's being sought for now, or the police are connecting him with. Can you just explain briefly what that is?
Absolutely. Connecticut State Police are currently investigating Raviza in connection with the death of a 70-year-old man in Deep River, Connecticut. The body of Bruce Feldman was found outside a house on Saturday afternoon. This is after police responded to a report of an audible disturbance. So the case is classified as an active homicide investigation, and criminal charges are pending while Raviza is in custody in Massachusetts. Man, there is suspicion that Raviza could be involved in his death.
That is Daniel Greenman of the Martha's Vineyard Times, where there's extensive coverage of this story. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Brewster residents went to the polls. One of the things they voted on were select board candidates, and one of them appears to have won now by the smallest of margins. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us to tell us about this story and more. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
This was one of those elections where two select board seats were up for grabs, and one was pretty clearly won by the incumbent, but the other seat was decided by this whisker-thin margin. Tell us about this.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because this is the second year in a row when that this has happened in Brewster. As you said, Mary Chafee, who's the incumbent, walked away with her position intact. She received the most votes in the three-person race for those two seats. But Amanda Brebin and Laurel Labden were really neck and neck during the counting all night. until even the last 10 ballots came out. And once those were all counted, the results showed that Brebin had won by 3 votes. Mm. The count was 1,458 to 1,455. It's especially upsetting, I think, to Laura Labden, because last year in the annual town election, she lost to Ned Chatelain by 6 votes. Hmm. So, you know, she had a very thin margin then, and there was a recount last year, which upheld that margin. You know, this year it was even closer. We haven't had word yet if there will be a recount, but it seems likely given the closeness of this race. We're still waiting to hear from that from the town clerk's office.
And you report here that the final 10 ballots were what really decided this race as they were counted up. People were watching. This must have been quite a dramatic moment.
Yeah, I kept going back and forth between Labden and Bebrin until those last few votes. There was just the narrowest margin going through the whole evening after the first precinct was counted, and those last few votes really pushed Bebrin over the top with just those 3 votes. Labden was reelected to the housing authority, so she's still involved in town government, it was a spirited contest between these three candidates, and we're looking forward to hearing what the next step is going to be in this.
I want to ask you about another story in the paper this week. The annual 4th of July Pancake Festival in Chatham may not sound like such a big deal to folks from other parts, but this is an event with a lot of history, and the news here is that this year it's going to be different.
Indeed. The Pancake Festival on the 4th of July morning has been happening for 57 years. It was run initially by the Kiwanis Club at the elementary school, which if you're familiar with downtown Chatham, the elementary school is just a block away from where the parade is held. So it was a great location. People would, Chatham on 4th of July morning for the parade is kind of a madhouse. It gets very crazy. Thousands and thousands of people, and many of them walk right by the elementary school. So it was a great place to have the Pancake Festival, very visible and very easy to get to. But unfortunately, this year the school is going to be closed once classes end in mid June. The school department is replacing some floor tiles in the elementary school, and there's a concern about asbestos. So basically, according to Superintendent Scott Carpenter, they're closing up the entire school. They've got to, isolate and seal off certain areas because of their concern about the asbestos. So the Rotary Club, which took over the festival from the Kiwanis Club a few years ago, they learned just a few weeks ago that they wouldn't be able to use the elementary school, and they had to scramble to find a new location. And they landed at the VFW on George Ryder Road, which is adjacent to the town's airport. It's a little bit out of town, so they're obviously not going to get the foot traffic that they would have at the elementary school, but they're still going ahead with the Pancake Festival, hoping that people who traditionally go to this event, your friends who are in the Rotary Club are flipping your pancakes and serving them to you. It's a real local thing. That'll be happening at the VFW beginning at 7 a.m. on July 4th.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
The state is proposing new regulations for coastal protection. They're focused on trying to protect coastal floodplains from things like climate change, sea level rise, and more intense storms. But if the majority of your town is located within a coastal floodplain with very little wiggle room, what kind of future are you looking at? Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent joins us with this story. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Steve.
We are describing Provincetown here, which is jammed up against the ocean with almost no room for retreat. Tell us what these new regulations could mean for the town.
Yes, that's exactly right, your description of Provincetown. So the new regulations that are being proposed by the Department of Environmental Protection, that's the State Department of Environmental Protection, would prohibit new development of any kind in what are called velocity zones. That's a FEMA term that refers to coastal areas where waves reach a height of 3 feet or higher during storms, and where the risk of flood damage is the greatest. And a good portion of Provincetown's waterfront is in these velocity zones. In addition, the FEMA and DEP define moderate wave action zones where waves reach 1.5 to 3 feet. So within the velocity zones, basically there could be no new development, and any reconstruction of existing buildings could happen only on open pilings and could not extend beyond the original building's footprint.
Okay, let me jump in here and ask you to, like, I'm going to try to translate that into a visual image. That means that if things are being built or reconstructed, say, in most of Provincetown or a big portion of Provincetown, they all have to be elevated off of on open pilings so that water can flow underneath them?
Exactly. Okay. Yes. And, you know, if you walk down Commercial Street in Provincetown these days, you'll see there are a couple of buildings that have been raised up onto these pilings. It's a little surreal, but that's what would be required for any kind of reconstruction. Mm. Right now, the rules do require that, but only if the reconstruction involves 50% or more of the value of the building. And, you know, the real estate prices are so high in Provincetown that that's a pretty high number. And you can do a lot of work and still stay under 50%. But these new regulations would change all that.
So the town manager, Alex Morris, we just have about a minute here. I want to get into the fact that he is kind of pushing back on these rules or trying to give some feedback to the DEP here about what the implications could be for a place like Provincetown, because these rules are maybe more designed for a town that has more room to retreat back from the ocean.
Exactly. And that's what Morse said in his comments to the DEP, which is collecting comments, public comments right now before they finalize their decision. Morse wrote, "With no space to retreat, improvements to bulkheads and resource areas are often only done in conjunction with development or redevelopment of landward structures and hardscapes." And he said the new rules would actually take away the ability of the local conservation commission to require certain kinds of mitigation and site improvements that would lessen the impacts of flooding. So he says he's asking the DEP to be more flexible in their rules, especially for a place like Provincetown that, as you say, has nowhere to go.
So these the DEP is formulating these rules now, they're still in the process of this. There's some room for shaping them, we're hoping.
Well, that's what we're hoping in Provincetown, at least, and that they will consider making them a little more flexible, at least for redevelopment to avoid the really catastrophic financial consequences that would result from having to do this kind of major change in what the town looks like.
It's Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent, where you can read all about it. Ed, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. A busy moment on Nantucket. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror joins us to catch us up on a couple of stories. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Back in April, human remains were found in some woods. It looked like they had been there for a long time. We don't know a lot here, but now some more information has come out. Police have identified these remains. Bring us up to speed here.
Sure. Those remains have been identified as Mary Macy, a 60-year-old woman who went missing in 2015 after last being seen walking near her Milestone Road home. The identity was confirmed on a death certificate obtained by the Inquirer and Mirror this week. When Mary Macy went missing back about 9 years ago, an extensive multi-day search turned up no sign of her. The date of death on the death certificate is April 4th, 2024, the day the bones were found, and the location is 260 Milestone Road, the location nearest to the bones where they were found, according to the police report from the time. The manner of death is still under investigation by Nantucket Police, but the death certificate does indicate it did not result from injury. Nantucket Police Lieutenant Angus McVicker declined to comment on that, other than to say that the investigation is still open. He did also say that Macy was positively identified the day after the bones were found back in April, didn't say exactly how that was done, and also said that the police did not release her identity then because Macy's family had asked them not to. The bones were found on the island's east end by two men looking for deer antlers. There was a skull, a partial pelvis, and other long bones, according to medical examiner Dr. Tim Leprey, who saw them after they were recovered by police. They were later sent to the state's office of the chief medical examiner to be identified, and that has happened now about 3 months after they were discovered and 9 years after Mary Macy went missing.
It must provide some closure to the family, and our thoughts go out to them. I want to ask you about another story. The Island Airport has been looking to expand. It's a controversial effort, and now the town's Board of Health is weighing in, suggesting that an expansion may impact public health. What's the detail in that argument?
Yeah, the Board of Health has jumped into the fray over the expansion of the airport's private jet parking area, saying there are a number of concerns about health and noise that the project may have. It is looking to ensure that there's follow-through on a series of amendments that passed at our most recent town meeting, seeking to further regulate the project. But what exact authority the board has at this point, however, is still a little unclear. Back in town meeting, in Article 3, which was an appropriation of more than $3 million for the airport expansion project, was an amendment connected to that funding that dictated that the permanent withdrawal of any PFAS-contaminated berm from the project be done, that the project be limited in use for only those aircraft that are towed into and out of the area, and that a noise and engine exhaust blast wall is installed to help out the neighbors. The work's already underway, but the amendment passed overwhelmingly, with many neighbors in the area speaking up about the concerns they had, and the Board of Health has started to echo those, but they are a little unclear at this point, though, what kind of jurisdiction or authority they may have. The airport itself is largely under the jurisdiction of the Federal Aviation Administration and not the town, and even the articles from town meeting, there's some question as to whether they are binding or not. So it's an issue that's going to move forward.
And did the Board of Health seem to take this up on their own? What was the impetus here for them to wade into this?
The impetus, I believe, was the town meeting articles. They felt, based on the discussion on town meeting floor about the proposed project, which had been approved years ago, that there was a potential public health impact here, and that they would be wise to stay on top of it and at least follow through and make sure that those amendments were carried out if they were legally able to be carried out.
That is Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Nowhere in the country is the cost of child care higher than in Massachusetts. Governor Healey says her administration will take steps to ease that burden. Our Morning Edition host Patrick Flannery spoke with our State House correspondent Katie Lannon about this story and more. Here's their conversation.
Hello there, Katie.
Hey, good morning.
Earlier this year, Katie, the Globe reported that Massachusetts has the highest child care costs across the country. But let's focus on preschool here. Governor Healey this week announced that it would expand access to universal pre-K in several districts, including New Bedford. How far will this money really go, and what will it look like for parents?
Yeah, this is part of the governor's ultimate goal to bring universal preschool access to gateway cities in Massachusetts by 2026, with a broader kind of more amorphous goal of getting there statewide. So this money goes to 6 participating districts to help them add 10 preschool classrooms. So that's 259 seats in cities across the state, which isn't a huge dent, but if you're one of those families, is certainly going to make a difference. In New Bedford in particular, the school superintendent there has said this is something they've been working to do at the city level with community organizations, expand preschool access for a while, and they're seeing benefits in children's academic and social development.
There was a cute headline in Politico Massachusetts Playbook this week, Katie, regarding the election, which is just 5 months out now. And the headline read, "Almost nothing to see here." The implication, I guess, being that a lot of familiar faces are running unopposed and that this election will be more of the same?
Yeah, that's pretty much the situation. Out of 200 seats in the legislature, so if you look at 40 in the Senate, 26 senators are unopposed and 104 out of 160 state reps. So that's very little action electorally. Things are a little different in the southeastern Massachusetts, the Cape and the islands, in part because there's turnover. There are contested races for open seats where people are leaving. Interestingly, as long-term state rep Sarah Peake plans to leave from the Provincetown area, one of those, well, that race is also uncontested. There's only one candidate on the ballot there so far, Hadley Luddy of Orleans, and that's, you know, to give you an idea of how non-competitive the elections are broadly, that's someone who doesn't hold a House seat already, but is poised to join the legislature in January without facing competition.
Right. The state's Commission on LGBTQ Youth is out with a pretty big report this week. It recommended a number of ways that lawmakers can better shape programs and policies when it comes to vulnerable young people. Katie, what stood out to you with this report, and do these recommendations ever have a chance at really shaping policy at the State House?
One thing that's interesting about these reports is that the scope of them, as you mentioned, there's dozens of recommendations across areas like homelessness and housing, mental health, environmental justice, healthcare. So there's a lot that could move. We did see this week the Judiciary Committee gave a favorable report to one of the bills that this commission is calling for passage of. That's legislation that would update and streamline the parental rights for LGBTQ families where one of the parents is not the biological parent of a child. And I think a thing to keep in mind too about this report is it does put these issues in front of lawmakers directly that may not be on their mind. Rep. Sam Montano from Boston, the only out person of color in the legislature, really commended the commission this week for helping put issues, particularly those affecting Black and Brown LGBTQ youth, at the forefront when those are things that, because of a lack of representation in the legislature, aren't always at the top of mind for all lawmakers.
That is Katie Lennon from the State House post-Memorial Day. I know it's been a busy one there. Katie, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is CAI Morning Edition host Patrick Flannery speaking with our State House correspondent Katie Lannon. This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. New Bedford is the nation's top dollar port for fish landings, but in the last year, two significant sections of the dockfront there, used by commercial fishing boats, have collapsed suddenly. Will Sennett of the New Bedford Light joins us with this story. Hi, Will.
Hey, morning, Steve.
I would say that these sections of dock collapsed unexpectedly, and in one way, I guess they did, but in another way, their condition was no secret. And in fact, I guess a company has been working to rebuild one of these sections, which then collapsed. Tell us what's happening here.
Yeah, so this, as you mentioned, New Bedford is one of the top fishing ports in the U.S. Some 400 million pounds of seafood come across the, move through the waterfront each year. It's a lot of weight. And something we don't think about is the actual integrity of the waterfront, the bulkheads, the piers themselves. This 2 mile stretch of port that makes up New Bedford waterfront. It's a lot of it was built a long time ago. It was built on the banks of the Acushnet River, it's a lot of wood pilings capped with concrete. And there's signs the city has spoken about the deteriorating conditions of sections of the pier for a long time, namely the section called the Northern Wharf, which is just on the northern side of the bridge here. It's a very busy part of the port. It's hosts a few businesses, one being Eastern Fisheries, the nation's largest scallop fleet. The other one being Siwash, one of the largest clam companies on the East Coast. And yeah, like I said, a lot of weight moves across this part of the waterfront. And over the last few years, there's been serious signs that it's been decaying. For one, there's this about a foot long chasm that has been growing and stretching and, you know, showing signs of the ports, the pier will give way. The city has, and, you know, and the businesses that operate there have noticed this the potential of deterioration and potential for collapse for some years. Mm. Over the last 5 years, the city has moved to selling off these properties. The repairs are very expensive. And
let me ask, ask you about that. So the city's been watching these dock fronts as they're, you know, approaching this point where they're going to have to be repaired and realizing that the cost is formidable. And so one of the ways the city's dealt with this, and tell me if this is correct, they actually sold off two sections of the dockfront to the private companies that are using them, essentially saying that now you own this and now the repairs are your responsibility.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They, you know, these companies had kind of sweetheart deals with these, with the city, 99-year leases for as little as $50,000 a year. And the city said, you know, instead of, you know, being responsible for these repairs ourselves, let's offload these properties. Let's put this, you know, the burden of repairs fully on the businesses that, you know, have these long 99-year leases on those properties. You know, the company that owns the two sections of dock that collapsed, Eastern Fisheries, they were working to repair the dock. Actually, the first dock that section of dock that collapsed back in October was under construction at the time of its collapse. Four workers actually fell into the water during the collapse, two of whom were hospitalized. And the second one, which took place just back in April, it was not under construction at the time, at least yet. The business told me they had plans to renovate it.
So
the owner described it, just sort of gave away and slipped into the port.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, just to describe. So when it collapsed, there were this one section, there were people on the dock itself working on it when it gave way, and the other one just kind of gave way, but nobody ended up in the water. But nobody was killed here, but it's alarming that this would be happening while people are working on it.
Yeah, it was. Not just people, but, you know, a lot of heavy industrial machinery. Mm. OSHA actually stepped in after the just 2 weeks before the second dock collapse and fined the contractor who was carrying on the repairs $214,000 for, quote, willful and serious workplace safety violations, saying that the company failed to determine if the bulkhead had the strength and structural integrity to support employees safely. And that was just 2 weeks before the second dock then collapsed. So it's been in the eyesight of the city and OSHA now for quite some time.
We have just about a minute here. What happens next? Are these being rebuilt? And they must be integral to the operations of the port there.
Yeah, that's the city and these businesses are working on that right now. I mean, Eastern Fisheries has, you know, moved its operations elsewhere temporarily. However, Siwash, which is this large clam, you know, they're known for their these massive blue clam boats you might have seen. Their pier that they operate on right now is straddled right now on each side by one collapsed dock on each side of its operations. They're continuing on working. They have about six of these clam boats that can make up to two trips a week, and each trip carrying as much as 540,000 pounds of clams, you know, requiring cranes and multiple forklifts to offload. And the workers there, you know, the crane operators are all very concerned, you know, looking on each side and seeing the collapsed bulkheads on either side.
I bet. Will, we have to leave it there, but you can read all about it in the New Bedford Light. Will Sennett reporting there. Will, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff, Daniel Greenman of the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent, and Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. CAI's Patrick Flannery speaking to our State House correspondent Katie Lannon. Will Sennett there from the New Bedford Light. Thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week.